The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
For my talk this morning, I'd like to offer you a topic which has been on my mind for much of the last week. I just came back Thursday from Spirit Rock, where I co-taught a retreat and meditation study retreat on the topic of emptiness. And many people have teased me about how could you have a whole week, enough to talk about for a whole week on the topic of emptiness. The emptiness is a very central teaching in Buddhism. It gets a lot of attention in the Mahayana tradition, the Buddhism of Tibet and China and Japan, where it's considered to be one of the central philosophies. And it's a very rich, multivalent word. It's kind of like it's a word that lends itself to a lot of different meanings. And so Buddhists have taken it in many different directions. And so there's not just one teaching on emptiness, but there's many. Some of them are even contradictory. And given that emptiness is such an important topic in Buddhism, it hasn't always been... Buddhists haven't always agreed, and that's... Some Buddhists have been critical of the teaching of emptiness and have offered other teachings. So it's a rich area of exploration. And because the word is maybe a little, the way the Buddhists use it is foreign to many people in the West. Some people, when they hear that Buddhism, that emptiness lays at the heart of Buddhism, they get quite alarmed because they associate it with nihilism, with the kind of, emptiness. You know, something that's empty means it's kind of vain or has no value, or if you feel empty, and if you go tell your therapist how empty you feel, they wonder whether you're depressed. You go tell a Buddhist teacher how empty you are, and they'll say, "Oh, that's nice." and though, if you're using, if you're missing each other's reference points, meanings of the words, you might misunderstand what you're each talking about. So maybe given the many different meanings of emptiness, and how rich it is in association, let me read you a story. The janitor was one of the most radiant monks in the monastery. His peace and joy inspired everyone who met him. Never seeming to want anything, he had a knack of being in the right place at the right time when others needed help. He was always thorough in doing his job, and no one had ever seen him bothered by anything. One day, he was asked if monastic life had ever been difficult. This is what he said. "Before coming to the monastery, my life was very hard. I considered ending my life because my suffering was so great. For me, the monastery was the end of the road. I saw it as my last chance. When I first arrived, I had a long interview with the abbess. She asked me lots of questions. I told her things about my life I had never revealed to anyone. At the end of the interview, she welcomed me to the monastery. As I took my leave, I asked what sort of spiritual practice I should undertake. The abbess looked at me with such compassion and confidence that I thought she was preparing to tell me something very important. But all she said was, 'Always walk completely through the doors.' For the rest of that day, I wondered if I'd heard correctly. How could walking through doors be helpful advice to someone as despondent as me? Perhaps the old woman was becoming senile. The next day, to my surprise, the monastery doors started talking to me. Every time I went through a door, I heard a faint whisper. At first, I thought I was imagining it, so I didn't give it much attention. But when the whispering kept reoccurring, I strained to hear what was being said. Finally, I was able to make out the words. It seemed each door was whispering the same thing. It is all empty. I asked the other monks and nuns if they too heard the voices, but none did. I asked them if they knew the meaning of "it is all empty." They just smiled and shrugged their shoulders, as if they didn't have a clue. Pretty quickly, I decided that the voices were a reminder of the life I had left behind. All my possessions, along with the endless pursuits I'd run after, the burning drive for recognition, the insatiable womanizing, all of that was indeed empty. The whispering doorways seemed to be reassuring me that I had made the right decision in coming to the monastery. They were reminding me that no longer was there anything outside the monastery walls for me to go after. So at first, the voices made me happy. Convinced that the world I had left behind was shallow, I threw myself wholeheartedly into the monastic routine. What a delight it was to have finally found a meaningful life. But as the doorways continued to whisper, "It is all empty," I began to have doubts about monastic life as well. Was this life also hollow, meaningless? Adding to my concerns, the voices started to grow louder. Before long, I felt as much despair about monastic life as I had about my previous life. Trying to find something that would give meaning and purpose to my life, I decided to devote more time to meditation and thereby develop my inner life. Certainly, the pursuit of real spiritual attainments would be meaningful. The meditation practice seemed to lighten my despair. And when my meditations were deep, I was filled with confidence. I began to feel quite happy, even happy-go-lucky. I had found the key to happiness and was convinced that I was surpassing all the other monks in holiness. But every time I left the meditation hall, the doors whispered again, "It is all empty." After a while, this began to grate on me. I became increasingly angry because the voices seemed to suggest my newfound identity as a deeply spiritual person was empty. When the anger became too much to bear, I was forced to admit that I had been caught in pride and that my vanity, too, was empty. Once the anger passed, I carried on with my meditation practice. After all, nothing else seemed to make sense. Then the voices started commenting on the meditation itself. I heard again, "It is all empty." Did this mean that meditation itself was meaningless? My despair returned with a vengeance. I tried hiding in my room so I wouldn't have to go through any doors. I took to climbing through windows whenever possible. If I did have to pass through a door, I ran through it trying to distance myself from the voices. By now, the voices had grown very loud. As I ran down the halls, the phrase, "It is all empty," echoed after me. After a while, every thought I had, every wish I hoped for, and every effort I made was assaulted by, "It is all empty," resonating throughout the monastery. I couldn't take it anymore. I ran toward the front gate of the monastery, intending to find a tall mountain cliff and throw myself off. It no longer made any sense to keep on living if life was going to be so hard. But as I came to the front gate, the doors loomed large in front of me. I was too frightened to pass through them. I felt I couldn't survive one more voice telling me that it is all empty. I stood there frozen for a long time. But then I remembered the practice of the old abbess had given me on my first day in the monastery. Always walk completely through the doors. The instruction seemed so useless the first time I heard it. Now it seemed monumental. Still, I could not manage to get myself to pass through the front gate. Inside my head, a voice kept repeating, "It is all empty. It is all empty." My mind couldn't find any object to rest on because when it did, I was reminded that it too was empty. My mind became increasingly contracted, turning in on itself. It kept pulling away from everything until all that was left was the frightened mind itself. Then, one last time, a voice boomed out, "It is all empty." And with that, I let go of my mind. Since that day, the voices stopped, and I've never again worried about the meaning of anything. Neither despair nor hope is relevant for me. Happily, emptiness penetrates everything, permeates everything. So I wrote this story. It's in my new book called The Monastery Within. And when I wrote it, the intention was to have the phrase, "It is all empty," be said really neutrally. There was no value, no judgment. Just, it's all empty. And then let this poor monk cope with that phrase. And so this is the way he coped or didn't cope with it. So for some people, the idea it is all empty is frightening. It feels like then everything is meaningless. In Buddhism, it's actually a teaching that's supposed to give a lot of hope. It actually, in some ways, gives meaning to life in a way that hopefully you'll see by the end of the talk. In the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, emptiness is seen as a central philosophy, and you can study fantastic works of philosophy that go into tremendous detail, volume after volume, around the philosophical meaning of this term emptiness. In the Theravada tradition, the early tradition that we are part of here at IMC, emptiness is not really used as a word to refer to a kind of overarching philosophy. And so it doesn't get emphasized a lot or taught much, because rather than a philosophy, it's meant to be a realization. It's meant to be something gets revealed and understood as practice deepens. And so in the ancient meditation manuals, for example, they talk about emptiness, but they only do it for people who are attain some deep level of insight and concentration. And then it makes sense to talk about this emptiness. And the Buddha himself talked about emptiness, and he talked about sometimes abiding in emptiness, and some of his monks talked about abiding in emptiness. He said he was asked once, "How should we view the world?" And the Buddha said, "You should view the world as being empty, and if you do that, then death will not frighten you, death will not bother you." So in the early tradition, there are three ways of understanding this teachings on emptiness. And I think it's a very convenient kind of way of dividing it. It's easy to remember, I think. There's empty, emptiness. There's empty, emptying, and emptiness. There's what is empty. There's a process of emptying. And there's emptiness itself. And so what's empty involves insight, involves seeing in a particular way and seeing that things are empty. Now, as with the teaching on not-self, there's often an instruction, you know, to see things as not-self, and that's troublesome for people. How can there be no self? I think it's very useful and or meaningful or important not to start with the abstracts, abstract ideas, generalizations. And I don't think the Buddha did that. Though it's very easy when you hear these kinds of teachings to make an abstraction from it and relate to it through the abstraction. And you find actually even books on Buddhism start with the abstraction and then try to explain it, and often they end up in philosophical quagmires if you start in the abstract realm. So just even to say there is no self is an abstraction. And so then you end up in trouble. If you say it is all empty, it's kind of an abstraction. And then it's, you know, you have to explain that. But there's another approach, another way to place a start. And that is you begin not by abstractions, but what you can directly see, what you can actually see for yourself. And if you look carefully at your life, and the world around you, then certain things that you take as yourself, as being mine, you begin realizing that they're not inherently yours, not inherently who you are, and you begin loosening that grip of self around it. So some of you, for example, used to be, I imagine, maybe it's still the case, but many people, when they were quite young, had a certain attachment to their body and what they look like and their clothes that tends to decrease as people get older. And, you probably don't care so much, most of you, anymore, if all your friends see you with a zit on your nose in the way that you might have when you were 14 and going to high school, or 15 or something. And you realize that maybe, a zit doesn't define who you are. It's not like your identity is around your complexion of your skin in the same way it was earlier. And so you might say, well, I'm not really my complexion. It's part of who I am for sure, but I'm not organizing my whole sense of self around that. Or I'm not really the clothes I wear. Or you might see that in someone else who's caught up in clothes. You say, well, that's not really. Clothes don't make the person. And you kind of see that. And then you begin seeing, if you look at particular qualities that you have, you might see that your emotions come and go, and you realize that there's some kind of stability of attention, of intention, of other values that seem to override the strong identification with emotions. And you realize emotions are certainly part of me, but it doesn't make sense to organize my sense of self, to define myself by the presence and absence of certain emotions. I'll try to be wise with them, but in a sense, those emotions are not me in some defined way. Or you have thoughts that are come and go. And sometimes we identify very closely with our thoughts. We're locked in. Some people think the thoughts are who they are, and so it's very frightening not to think. But all kinds of thoughts can come and go. And after a while you realize maybe you don't identify so strongly with them. One of the little wonderful teachings that I received from my father when I was about 14, he took me aside and said, Gil, as you grow up, periodically you're going to have some really bizarre thoughts. And everyone has that, he said. Maybe none of you do, but that's what he said. And that's what happens. Mind does that, and it's okay. Don't worry about it too much. And periodically, I've had some bizarre thoughts, but that little teaching stayed with me, and so I didn't identify. I didn't say, "Oh, this defines who I am. This is something I have to believe or get involved in, or this is something I have to now have some horrific idea of this is who I am." And so I held much more lightly. Or my wife, who went through temporary, when she was about, I don't know how old, mid-30s, I think, temporary medically induced menopause. And took some pills, some hormone pills, and for some medical procedure she had to have done. And at one point she said to me, "I'm having thoughts that are not my thoughts." Whose thoughts are they? So there's often a strong kind of glue or grip, super glue, between us and our thoughts. At some point, it's possible to loosen that up and to see thoughts passing through, and there's no need to latch onto them. This defines me, this is who I am. And there's a whole series of things. If you actually look carefully, you realize it doesn't make sense to latch on, this defines me in some absolute way. These things are not my true, eternal, absolute self. These are all changing and in flux and all kinds of things. And so it's one thing to say, you can't see, as you look around, you can't see something that is yourself. It's another leap than to say, because of that, there is no self. You see that difference? So you look around and you can't see, in your body, this is my true eternal self. In my feelings, this is my feelings are not my true eternal self. My thoughts are not my true eternal self, who I essentially am. Even my consciousness in Buddhism, as you look carefully, you see it doesn't make sense to identify with that. So it's possible to see that, And then you say, well, therefore there is no self. Or someone might say, well, therefore there must be some self that's eternal and permanent that I just can't see. You know, some metaphysical realm. Both those are kind of abstractions that can't be proved and have no real role in Buddhist practice. You don't need to say there is no self, and you don't need to posit some self that's outside of our empirical experience. What Buddhism is focusing on is not making some claim about what the self isn't or isn't in some absolute way. It's really saying, when you look carefully, what do you see? And you'll see that the things you can actually, you'll notice, you know, that you'll understand the things you can actually see or experience directly, those in those things, it doesn't make sense to attribute a self or find a permanent abiding self in those things, create a permanent abiding identity around those things. Is this making some sense? Some sense, okay? And so the same thing with if you look, then it's empty. These things are empty of a permanent abiding self. So one of the meanings of empty in the early tradition is insight that it's empty of self and what pertains to self in some permanent abiding essential place. And this is considered a very important insight in Buddhism, and it's not an insight that you have to talk yourself into, believe it because someone sells you, but as the mind gets concentrated, as the mindfulness gets stronger, and you actually see with greater detail, you'll see that this is the case. That it doesn't make sense to attribute, hold on to something as this is my true, eternal, absolute idea of who I am. And this to see it that way is very helpful, not because it makes you a good philosopher, but because of the way in which human beings tend to cling to things as being themselves. If I cling to my zits, lack of zits, and I get a zit, I'll suffer, like I did when I was 14. I don't want to go to school today. Please, this is, you know, mortifying. And so I'm not so prone to that suffering anymore. I've matured a little bit since then. But when I was 14, that was a big deal. So, but if you can see that these things don't, you know, it's not source of, you know, not something to attach to, then we release the grip that we have on it, and we release that grip, we become freer and happier. And many of you, I'm sure, have had that experience in your life, that things that you were latched onto as being yourself, your true self, what defined you, as you've grown older, you no longer hold on that way. And you say, what was I thinking of back then? I'm so glad not to do that anymore, to be attached to that being who I am. And some of that comes naturally with experience, with aging and many different things. But certainly as people get older, it seems to be the case. What Buddhism offers you is premature aging.
Wrinkles optional.
Wrinkles are optional. They say that your wrinkles tend to, wrinkles get fewer as you meditate a lot. So that kind of aging, you know, doesn't happen, but as quickly perhaps. But premature aging in the sense that maturity, that wisdom, that you say, you know, I don't have to pick this sense of self up and be so attached to it and be so concerned that this is who I really am, and or this is, you know, I have to be a certain way so people see me this way. You know, as you get older, you don't, you know, as you mature, hopefully you're freer and freer from concern with image. So in the early tradition, the idea that things are empty had a lot to do with things are empty of self or what pertains to self. It also, I wanted to say that you also see that things, anything that you look at, doesn't have any real essence in and of itself. And everything that exists arises because of causes and conditions, part of a causal chain, a stream of things unfolding. Things don't exist in and of themselves, they exist in dependence on other things. And so the insight into emptiness in the early tradition is an insight into how things arise and pass because of causes and conditions. And this is considered to be very important good news in Buddhism, Because if things exist because they're there, because in dependence on certain conditions, if you change the conditions, the things that you want to have go away can go away. And what we want to have go away in Buddhism is suffering. And if your suffering had some true, abiding, essential, absolute existence, then you're stuck with it. But because your suffering arises out of conditions, as you change those conditions, your suffering can go away. And the primary condition that Buddhism focuses on in terms of suffering is clinging and grasping. And you can have some role in decreasing that, clinging and grasping, and therefore your suffering. And so to be able to actually see that the things you have been holding on to aren't worth holding on to, or aren't capable of holding on to, don't qualify as what you thought they were, a self, that helps release the grip. So one of the values of meditation Buddhism is this deeper, settled, concentrated mindfulness, where we see things, we see through the concepts, see through things that normally we don't see through, we don't penetrate. We're caught up in our ideas and concepts of how they are. So that's the empty side. Then there's the emptying side of this early tradition. And the emptying is the emptying of the mind of extraneous activity of the mind, extra things. I mean, I think that we have in English the expression of emptying your mind. Sometimes if you want to start some activity fresh, you want to make us just empty my mind first before I start that. I'm so caught up with what happened at work today, I have to empty my mind before I can really be home with my family or before I do something. And so people have various techniques they use to empty their mind. Some people meditate, some people exercise, some people shower, some people watch television, do something, just kind of let normal concerns pass away. And in fact, it's well known now that I think that the primary sources of stress has to do with the mind's preoccupation with its thoughts. And that if anything that can help you stop thinking incessantly about what's stressing you out will tend to help a person become calm. So emptying the mind of its incessant thoughts and activities. But meditation can go much further than that. So you sit down to meditate, and you first find your mind thinking a lot about things. And I think for many people, when they first meditate, maybe their thinking mind, you know, doesn't seem like such a big problem because we fall into it so easily. After 5 minutes, wait a minute, I'm thinking. But at some point, as meditation progresses, some people find that at some point you're so consciously aware that you're thinking in a way that you wouldn't in daily life. We just go from one thought to the other. So meditation, you're so clear you're thinking, and you're aware that, you know, thinking about this is not that helpful. Thinking about this anymore is not that nice even. It's not that comfortable even. I mean, why do I, you know, it's tiring. Why should I keep thinking and thinking about the same thing over again? It's kind of like getting old now. In a way you would never reflect, or almost never, maybe in daily life, where we just go on thinking, you know, without even thinking we're thinking. We don't reflect on it. We're just thinking one thing after another. And it's really quite something in meditation to get a little different perspective on the thinking mind and then perhaps realize this is enough. Enough of this. This is not so useful anymore. And, you know, I'm sitting here at IMC meditating. I don't have to think about what happened at home or at work in my neighborhood anymore. Let me let go of this. And if you're lucky enough, and maybe you can let go of those thoughts. And if you keep developing the concentration, other times in other places, thinking about the past and future elsewhere, just falls away. And you're kind of quite remarkable to feel like you're really here. You're just here, in this place here. And it feels kind of special to have the mind kind of stop all its other churnings and you're just here in a very full, viscerally full way. But then, at some point, as you get more still and concentrated, the idea of being here at IMC, the sense of the other people in the room and the building and the location, kind of falls away from the mind. Because that's also involves the mind perceiving or conceiving of a place and people and room. And though it's accurate enough, that activity of the mind is not really needed if you're going to get really peaceful and still. And so some people find that as they get more concentrated in meditation, they kind of lose touch with the room around them. They're no longer thinking about it, no longer focused on it, no longer perceiving it. And so we say in Buddhism that their mind then becomes empty, is emptying itself of the environment, their thoughts, conceptions of what's going on around. And then it can feel very precious to be here in this body, and you just feel very close and very intimate. And you feel your body, you feel your presence, you feel really in the present moment in a very, very powerful, strong way. And it feels usually quite peaceful and happy or contented, because the general forces that make us discontent are no longer present in our mind. And so we're here. It feels very nice to be so intimate. But then as the mind gets more concentrated, the sense of being here in a body falls away, because have a sense of having a body is a conception, is a perception the mind creates and makes that is innocent enough, but it's still an activity of the mind. And as the mind gets quieter and quieter, it lets go of what's coarser or more disturbing. Not disturbing in a conventional sense, but disturbing for the deepening of peace. So you let go of, it happens kind of naturally, that as you get more concentrated, you even let go of, you know, the sense of being in a body. And sometimes people report that their sense of body disappears. I once opened my eyes in meditation because I was concerned I disappeared. Where am I? You know, I'm not here anymore. And anyway, I opened my eyes. In fact, I was here. I hadn't gone anywhere. I hadn't become invisible. And and so then, so this emptying process continues. And so after a while, there's just sensation in the body. And if the mind gets more concentrated, even the sense of the sensations of the body without a body being there falls away. And the mind gets simpler and simpler. And as it gets simpler this way, the mind gets more happy, more peaceful, more joyful. It's really sublime and beautiful, the sense of well-being and peace can come. When the mind is not churning and actively involved in the conceiving of our world and our reality as it usually is. And there's a beautiful process of the thoughts and our emotions and feelings, our sense of body, becoming thinner and thinner, more transparent, more translucent, just thinner, more wispy, and the sense of getting thinner and thinner, you can feel the process of thinning out. Thoughts become thinner, more space between our thoughts. The thoughts no longer seem to have a lot of substance. There's not much grip. We don't really grip our thoughts, or our thoughts don't have us in a grip. And there's kind of thinner and thinner, and a thought might arise. And the image in Buddhism is, it's like just a wispy cloud in an endless sky. And so the mind becomes, the awareness feels like this big, open, spacious expanse. And a thought just arises, and, you know, there's no tendency to latch onto it or hold on to it or do anything with it. Just watch it come and go, kind of wispy and thin. And as things thin out more and more, you can see that it feels so satisfying to enter into this deeper and deeper states of peace and well-being. It's a phenomenal sense of happiness. And so the process of thinning and thinning just seems like a welcoming thing, because it just leads to greater peace. And things are thinner and thinner, the mind, thoughts, emotions, feelings, body, just thinner and quieter and thinner and quieter. And at some point, there's just a very small filament left. So the mind's emptying itself of all this stuff, and just a filament left of... And at some point, it just feels like, you know, the best thing that could possibly happen is even that last filament dissolves or breaks. And then that also gives away. And a total emptying of the mind. And then it says that a person experiences a certain kind of liberation or freedom from that. And one of the freedoms from that is quite remarkable, is to have a kind of visceral, immediate experience of feeling peaceful, happy, safe, contented, tremendous, meaningful experience, where the mind is not focused on anything, is not obsessed about anything, not caught up in anything, not defining anything, not conceiving anything, not even perceiving anything. I like to refer to it as the heart has settled on itself. The heart is at peace with itself, as opposed to a heart which is searching and wanting and trying to get something. And so then, but that's this final kind of thinning out, the most important and significant aspect of this emptying process that goes on in the mind is the emptying of the mind of greed, hate, and delusion, which is considered kind of the root for all the unskillful, unhelpful states of mind that can bubble up inside of us. And so having a visceral experience of the mind completely free of greed, hate, and delusion makes it you're much less likely to pick up greed, hate, and delusion when you come out of that deep meditation. And so maybe it's not going to operate as strongly, or you're not so entranced or addicted to the forces of greed, hate, and delusion. They don't have you so much. And so that experience of the mind, which is completely empty of greed, hate, and delusion, is called a mind which is abiding in emptiness. So I said, there's what's empty, there's a process of emptying, and there's the state of emptiness. We realize that everything is empty in a particular way. They're empty of any enduring, permanent, inherent, intrinsic sense of self or idea of self or identification with self. They're empty of eternal process, eternal kind of substance. Everything's in process. And because everything's in process, it comes together because of causes and conditions, we can get involved in that process and change the flow of the process, change the direction it goes, and make a difference in our lives. And one of those differences that we can make is we can begin emptying the mind of all the stuff that we do in the mind which is extra. And when you're sitting in meditation, there are things which are not extra when you're at work, what you have to do, which are extra here when you're sitting meditating. And so you learn slowly to let go of the grip, the attachments that keep all kinds of concerns going when they're not necessary to have those concerns operating. And so there's a process of emptying. And when the mind has reached the ultimate capacity of emptying, full emptying, then it's said to be abide in emptiness. And when and then if a person comes out of this full emptiness, experience of emptying completely, and are no longer prone to operating from greed, hate, and delusion, then the tradition, the early tradition says that this is the unsurpassed emptiness. The unsurpassed emptiness is when you can operate in the world around us, operate in our world, without having greed, hate, and delusion as an underlying motivating force for how we think and how we live and how we act in the world. So the early tradition talks about what's empty, talks about emptying as a process, and talks about the state of emptiness when the mind has attained a certain degree of purity or freedom. As Buddhism developed, this pragmatic focus on teachings of emptiness sometimes tended to be lost. And instead of being so pragmatic, they tended to be more philosophical. And you develop certain schools of Buddhism, certain schools of Mahayana Buddhism, increasing emphasis on the philosophy of emptiness. And sometimes it seems to me it misses the point. It's interesting in itself, but... So I offer that to you today, and if you have Mahayana friends, it's a common thing for the Mahayana people to say, well, you guys have, you know, teach about the empty, you know, the emptiness of self, but we have real emptiness. And you guys never talk about emptiness, you talk about not self. And now you know that this early tradition that we're part of actually does talk about emptiness, does emphasize it, and has a role for it, and actually does it in different ways. And so now we can, you know, stand tall on the Buddhist stage. We have emptiness too. Look at us, how special we are. We're the special, wonderful kind of emptiness people. We're completely empty of self. Nothing we're attached to. You should know that we're emptiness too. So
Isn't it terrible?
You do this Buddhism stuff, and Buddhism doesn't give you much to hold on to. So I hope this talk made enough sense for you, and enough sense at least to realize, to appreciate that this is an important teaching, and perhaps as your practice deepens, some of this will come back, and Gail's talked about this. I see. This is how it works. So thank you very much.